Hello, everyone. Ukrainian spaces is back after a bit of a pause since the middle of last week. But also, guys, an important announcement that Ukrainian spaces, at least the live broadcast part, is wrapping up the first season by the middle of July, and then we're already planning the season number two that is going
Yeah.
to be back on August 24th on
Yeah.
the Ukraine's Independence Day.
And the reason for that is that we actually have a big backlog of amazing podcasts we did over the past however many months that we are yet to publish and have you guys listen to again as well. So we need some time to do our production side of things and have a new season for you ready, as Maxim says, by the end of the summer.
Yeah, and thanks to our expansion and our team, we are also uploading those recorded broadcasts as podcasts more often. I probably already mentioned or saw that each of those days a new episode comes on. But also, you can catch them on Spotify and Apple, and also Google Podcasts and Anchor and a lot of other places. So please do check out and, most importantly, rate them and comment them. This is very important for us to trend on those platforms when you do that. And thank you so much also for our Patreon sponsors, because Ukrainian Spaces is still 100% independent volunteer effort supported by our sponsors. And the work that we are able to keep doing and expand now is 100% thanks to your support. You get a lot of bonus content on our Patreon page as sponsors, but most importantly, when we do have live broadcasts, just stop by, ask questions in person if you have them, or leave them on Patreon page or send them in DMs during the broadcasts. We would love to give you that opportunity to ask those questions as well.
Yep. And before we jump in and tell you a little bit about why we're here, I just wanted to ask Maxim how you're doing. We haven't done this in a while. We've had a bit of a break, and just wanted to check in.
I think we had a lot of conversations with a lot of Ukrainians in recent days because of the terrorist acts that happened in Kremenchuk, the bombing of shopping mall that is still very hard to process for everyone, and then a series of very nasty terrorist attacks on civilian objects like apartment buildings. And a lot of Ukrainians, I see that a lot of Ukrainians post and ask themselves that they have this guilt that sometimes whatever you do, it feels a bit out of touch, and you double question yourself, like whether I should be talking about anything else or do anything else amid this genocide and amid this terror. And I think
Yeah.
this is a question that a lot of Ukrainians are extra grappling these days, and it's hard to find the definite answer what we should do. Whether
Yeah.
we should concentrate just on one topic together, or maybe we should double down on whatever we've been doing, because this is the ultimate kind of fuck you to terror that you
Yeah.
can do.
And I think the other thing I also just wanted to bring up, since I think it's like super important to raise here, is the fact that it's not been made easier with Instagram and Facebook, basically Meta, just severely clamping down on anything Ukrainian on their platform, which on their platforms, I've seen like crazy stuff, like a post about like an excerpt, a photo of an excerpt from a newspaper from the day Ukraine became independent, and someone shared it on their stories, and it was hidden as sensitive content. And I just think it's just horrific and horrendous, and I don't understand what's going on. And I think we should seriously talk about it more and see where we can move in this regard together, because it's getting a bit out of control.
Definitely. And one of the ideas that we also had, that maybe use the hashtag Ukrainian Spaces to share those examples, because of course we know that something is wrong is happening with Meta algorithms, both on Facebook and Instagram, that increasingly censor any mentions of Ukraine in any forms, not only graphic content related to war crimes and terrorism. So if you see something, say something, and we're happy to amplify. And I know that people already keep sending me ridiculous examples, like, for example, Instagram marking as sensitive the picture of Ukrainian passport. So, yeah, I think it helps if we just, we becoming loud about it, and there's enough evidence for social media platforms to finally address this horrendous censoring that is happening. So, yeah. Okay, guys, so I think let's maybe jump into today's topic, because we have two featured Ukrainians today, not one. And that's why we would love to use this space as efficiently as possible to feature them as well as possible. So should we introduce Ukrainian spaces for those who come for the first time, or jump right in to our featured Ukrainians?
I think we can actually jump right into our featured Ukrainians because we do it quite often and remind everyone. And I think by now a lot of people know why we're here, but it's essentially to give Ukrainians the space to express themselves and educate people outside of Ukraine about Ukraine from Ukrainians. So, Maxim, I'll pass over to you for introductions.
So our golden rule is still the same. We never introduce our featured Ukrainians and allow them to introduce themselves. So I don't know which, I mean, I don't know who to start with, but Nika, maybe
I can
you.
start. I can
Oh,
start.
got
I'm
it.
ready. Okay. Yeah, so I'm
So,
Katrina. Yeah.
go ahead, please.
Yeah, I'm Katrina Sargatskova. I'm a journalist. I'm a editor-in-chief of Zaborona Media, a Kyiv-based news outlet that writes about human rights, equality, and Ukrainian contemporary culture. After Russia decided to fully invade Ukraine, we switched from multiple topics to the one main topic. It's human rights violations by Russia, because every day, as you know, we can see horrible things that Russia do to the Ukrainians. And we cover this genocide from different sides. So we try to collect all the evidence of this horrible attack on Ukraine. So yeah, and previously, before the invasion, Zaborona was one of the Ukrainian news outlets who covered also different radical movements in Ukraine and in Russia and other countries in so-called post-Soviet space. I really don't like this description about post-Soviet because so, post-Soviet should be remaining in the history.
Time to
So
bury it.
so let's say Eastern Europe, okay. And we looked into far-right movements pretty deep. So I can say a lot about this, and also about how international press covered the far-right issues in Ukraine. So I think it would be great to discuss that.
And also, I want to get everyone's attention to the work of 2402 Fund that Katya also helps to run. I pinned a tweet from that fund to the broadcast, because it's also a very important work that I'm super grateful that you do. And basically, this fund provides financial assistance to thousands of Ukrainian journalists all across the country. Many people do not understand how big the country still is, and there are thousands of journalists working on the front line, and some of them never wanted to be a war reporters, but now they are. So thank you so much for that work, and I also want people to check that fund. Nika, could you please also introduce yourself to the rest, who you are, where you come from, and what your life has been since the genocide started.
I am an executive editor of the New Voice of Ukraine. It's an English language version of NVUA, which is one of the leading Ukrainian media, along with Ukrainska Pravda, I mean Ukrainian language. So this is, I actually edit the English language version of it. We had a story on Azov not so long ago. Also, I covered Azov for the Kyiv Post when it was still good. I investigated Azov for OCCRP. So I also know quite a lot about Azov. And also, I can say that I noticed many of those Western reporters who were Azov critics and who made the names on labeling Azov as neo-Nazis are now self-censoring themselves, and it's a very interesting topic to discuss, I guess.
Yeah, so. And we'll go into depth into this topic as well, I think, with the next hour that we have a little bit less now. But guys, we're big believers with Maxim that the reason why what we do here is important is that it's important for people with lived experiences to lived experiences on a lot of the topics that we're talking about to really be at the forefront of leading the discussions on Ukraine and in general on the specific topics that we'll be talking about today. But I was wondering, and maybe Nika, you could tell us, and I'm sure everyone asks both Katya and Nika these questions, but essentially we just wanted to know where were you when the war started, and yeah, how did you meet the war in Ukraine? And perhaps we can start from there, because I think it's important for people to know as well contextually what was going on and what is going on.
I can be first. So I woke up on February 24 because I heard loud blast. First I thought it was a hallucination, but then it was a second blast very close to my apartment, because I live next to a heating power plant in Kyiv, which was contested, I would say, pretty much during the first days of the Russians wanted to seize the strategic object. So we had like intense fighting going on, because I live like almost outside Kyiv in Travieshchina. So yes, there was then we, as many of us, I think, I listened to Putin's rant about Ukrainians, this almost declaration of genocide. After that, there was like month of living in Kyiv. I never left. I moved to my granny because she needed help. And we observed how our city changed. We saw how Ukrainians in different districts were uniting and digging trenches, preparing food for those who were in need, hunting for medicine in pharmacies. Most of the pharmacies were closed. Like most of the stores were closed until like March, like mid-March, I guess. So yes, we saw how children disappeared from our city, and we saw how they returned. So I think that I never actually regretted that I stayed in Kyiv, because I really fell in love with my city finally, because I saw that people who usually are pretty annoying for me as a native Kyivan, I really like don't like the crowds, don't like this lots of tourists coming. So and then I finally understood how marvelous the city is and all those people it hosted, like whatever. So
yeah.
But sort also of... thank you so much, because through the first month, I think you quickly became this extremely crucial, important voice of Ukrainians for in English, telling very raw how it is, what it's like to live in a sieged, basically almost sieged city. And your reporting was incredibly, still incredibly moving, but also important and brave. And thank you so much. It was very important to read also for fellow Ukrainians who were outside of Ukraine, just to double check what is happening and to understand a bit what it's like to be on the ground as well. So thank you.
Thank you
so much for that. Katya, would you like to tell us how you met the war?
Yeah, sure. I will try to be short. You know, I have experience of covering the war in Donbas. I've been to the war zones since 2014. I've also been to Iraq, and I covered the war against ISIS in Mosul. So I'm pretty aware of how it sounds, like those sounds of explosions. And when I heard it on like at 5 o'clock in the morning in Kyiv, I understood that this is not fireworks. It doesn't sound good. And since I have 2 kids, I tried to put myself together, and then I tried to do the same with my Zabrona team, because they are like kind of my kids also. So I had to prepare people that it will be very hard. And still it is not very easy to hold on in the situation, because every day is like this first day of the war.
Are you here? Right, there's no connection problem.
I can hear it's... me. I can hear you, but I think maybe Katya was a little bit cutting out.
But
yeah, I can hear you.
I wanted to ask Katya right away, because you know, you both mentioned that infamous speech that we all heard just minutes before Ukraine started attacked with missiles. And in that speech, of course, Russian dictator pronounces submission to denazify Ukraine. And I think this is an issue that has been kind of on the top of Russian propaganda agenda for years, and they've been developing this fascist argument for a very long time to kind of come up with a reason why they need to genocide Ukrainians once again, at least from formal point of view. So I wanted to start with Katya, kind of ask you the question. Why do you think in what the West gets wrong about the far right problem in Ukraine, and why do you think this denazify message is still has some like tacit backing abroad? Why people are still not sure whether this message is ridiculous or not true? What do you think?
Well, let's start from the beginning. If we talked about Putin and his circle, their main goal is to dehumanize Ukrainians, and they just wanted to pick up the most difficult topics that still are in discussion in Europe, in the US, because we still have a problem with far-right movements across the globe, and somewhere we even have a rising of far-right movements, especially in America. So it was easy to take this problem and to make it so big in Ukraine. I mean, they created their propaganda that Ukraine is almost, you know, neo-Nazi nation, right? Which is obviously not true. It cannot be true. And they even claim that Ukrainian president, who is Jewish, is also Nazi, which is absolutely ridiculous. And they know that, but they just have to somehow, you know, just to claim that Ukraine is not a state that deserves living.
Yeah, but it's also important to, like, for Russian propaganda to point out that for them, everyone who disagrees with Russia all the time is a Nazi. So basically, that's a term that they used not only about Ukraine, but they use it about everyone. The West is fascist, you know. The Baltic states are fascist. Everyone who sends, you know, arms to Ukraine are fascists, and so on, so on.
Yeah, yeah. So they just say that anyone who defends their land and their country is a fascist. So we understand that this is not true, and they use part of reality and turned it into the propaganda. So it could be anything. We all know how they created you know, crucified boy or other things. But I think that that we have some issues with the far right in Ukraine, and they just took mm-hmm. it and made it big. You know, they made like thousands of fake news about that.
Yeah, they used it to
yeah,
their narrative around it.
Yeah, but I think it is not healthy to deny that we didn't have any issues with far right. So that's why we gathered tonight, I guess, to bring some information about what was going on. And how Russia used the issues to create their huge propaganda to destroy Ukrainians.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So, that's a perfect bridge. I know that Nika, you as well have done a lot of work on looking at, in general, obviously the propaganda of the Kremlin that's been used to fuel the war that's happening right now, but also, you know, internal situation in Ukraine. So I just wanted to ask you, since narratives and propaganda is one thing, but in your opinion and from your work and research that you've been doing, what is actually the situation with neo-Nazis, Nazis in Ukraine?
I would say that the situation in Ukraine is the same as the situation everywhere else right now. We have the problem with far right, yet it is not that widespread as in other countries, for example, in America or Hungary or even Lithuania. Or Poland. I would say that Ukrainian far right were labeled Nazis because of symbols they used. Also because Ukraine, in the eyes of many in the world, still is not equal enough. Therefore, I say that our far-right problem is highlighted because Russia is doing this, like using this problem to come and to denazify us. But it was not that way. It was like a favorite topic of the West, Western journalists, many, I guess we know. I won't name them, but still they're getting a lot of backlash right now because when you equal an ordinary Azov far-right guy who might be even a thug, like we know Maluta has this very interesting business on the side of Azov movement. So they are basically, they made Nazis of ordinary far-right guys or even thugs used by many in Ukraine to, for example, conduct raiding attacks. And they never like made difference between the different Azov movement, how to form it in the best way, that as they made Azov movement look the same. They never like estimated that there is Azov regiment, which is a part of the National Guard. There is National Corps, which is political project, like failed political project of Andriy Biletsky. They never mentioned that there was a time when this for hire, that's how I personally call Sergei Brodkiv, because he usually, well, let's say some guys were telling me that Sergei Korotkiv was protecting Protasov Yar illegal construction. I mean, those guys who conducted illegal construction there. So, and at the same time, the Azov movement has these guys who fought in Azovstal. They also can be considered a part of the Azov movement, yet they are more like decent, I would say. They are part of the National Guard. They had redemption, I would say. They protected our country, and they usually sacrificed everything for Ukraine. And I would never equal them with the guys like Biletsky or Korotkiv.
I have a perfect follow up here, but before that, I mean, you guys both mentioned the issue with far rights and how it's different from the rest of the world. And I think Katya was also brilliant in pointing out that Russian propaganda was so successful because they basically pinned the issue that it's so prevalent in other Western countries. But for the matter of fact, Ukrainian far-right groups have one of the lowest political power support in Europe. So nationalistic parties, which are not even sometimes could be labeled as ideally or clearly far-right, they have around just 2% of public support in Ukraine. And that figure compares to Hungary, what it's 50%, in France, you know, now it's like almost quarter, in Italy, it's 17%. And, you know, a lot of these figures and a lot of these forces that we now discuss and are being used to amplify the issue of far-right, Ukrainian far-right abroad, are quite recent characters, and they resurfaced with the Russian invasion in 2014, including the Azov battalion. So, Nika, I wanted to have a quick follow-up and then to Katya as well. What do you think is what is the big misconception or distortion when it comes to first and foremost foreign coverage of far-right issues and far-right groups in Ukraine? What do you think foreign journalists get wrong, or how would you do it differently if you were them?
I would say that I would not equal Nazis and far-right, because as one expert told me, unlike far-right, and radicals who usually want their own culture to like be special and to be above all, those far right, they usually do not invade other nations and suppress their rights to like make their own culture superior, while Nazis, they usually invade and kill for their own perversive beliefs. And this is what most of Western coverage did before the start of the invasion. The reporting radicalism right now has this far right and in brackets neo-Nazis. So this is, I think.
And has that, do you think, and a question to both of you, has that changed since the full-scale invasion, since February, or do you think a lot of media keep reinforcing the same the same things over and over again that you're talking about, Nika?
I would say that many of these big media companies, they are very bad at admitting their own mistakes. Therefore, they prefer now Azov movement stories. They usually report it like on a daily basis, mostly before that, or they, like CNN recently did, they say that something very unspecific, like, well, Azov is Nazis, but not like quite Nazis. They're like special Nazis, and this like messes people's minds even more. This is my opinion. I don't know what I can say.
Katya.
You know, when it comes to far right in Ukraine, we should say, like, who are those far right movements in Ukraine? And it is there are like different movements, and just wanted to tell you just shortly about them. For example, we have nationalists whose goal is to defend Ukraine's independence, and it is more about anti-colonialism process. They just want to they want Ukraine to be a sovereign state and to be not dependent on Russia, right? And you can recall. For example, the right sector. They are like absolutely nationalists. There are far right movements that came from Russia. And as Nika mentioned several times, Sergei Krotkih, Malyuta, he's from Russia, he's a Russian citizen. Who created a network of far right, very radical guys in Russia, like skinheads movement that attacked people in Russia, LGBTQ, different. Ethnical group representatives in Moscow and St. Petersburg. So they were just attacking people because of their religion, their skin color, sexuality, you name it. And after 2014, after the annexation of Crimea, Russian far-right movement was divided because some of them decided to stay in Russia and to salute Putin for the Crimea. And some of them decided to be with Ukraine, and many of them moved to Ukraine in 2014, and they just joined different local movements in Ukraine, and the another story of the development of those movements started. For example, Sergei Krotkih, he became one of the creators of Azov Battalion, along with Andriy Beletsky, and then he worked for the Ministry of Internal Affairs for 3 years, and actually he was responsible for how to say, just to invite people to join the Azov Battalion from different countries, and the Azov Battalion very quickly became a regiment under National Guard. So they separated the battalion from the political project, and Sergei Korotkikh joined this political project. He created a national squad under the Azov movement umbrella, and their goal was to take part in different protests across the country, and they attacked queer people, LGBT pride across the country. They participated in a Roma pogrom in Kiev, and that there were like lots of cases with the participation of this national squad members. But it was like kind of unofficial. It was not pretty like linked to the National Corps as a party or to Azov regiment as a you know, as a National Guard.
And also, it's probably very important to point out that, so to say, Azov or other prominent far-right groups that emerged in 2014, those are not the same groups today. And the people who were at the beginning with those groups are no longer with those groups today. And they went through also dramatic changes from within. Isn't that right?
Yeah, it's, that's absolutely true. Because some people from National Corps, they quit, and they had pretty wild conflicts with Sergei Korotkikh and Andriy Beletsky, for example, Nazar Kravchenko or Sergei Filimonov. They created a new movement which is called Gonar. And they like, I don't know, street activists. They are pro-democratic right now, and they decided, you know, to not to participate in those things.
For just wanted to point out that for everyone, I'm pinning some of the reporting that both Katya did. Please, you know, dig in, especially on the Russian neo-Nazis in, you know, their traveling across Ukraine and other Eastern European countries. But also Nika did a fantastic explainer on Azov itself, tackling this one of the largest myths about the links to Nazism and fascism and far rights. I think that explainer was just superb. And also I pinned an explainer, which I feel like absolute must for anyone who consumes the information about Ukraine in English, by our Ukrainian Spaces family members, Stas and Marichka. It's called How the World Got Tricked into Believing Ukrainians Have a Nazi Problem. And this is also a must to share.
Yeah.
Valeria, I know.
Wanted to just follow up because I think, you know, one of the things that's been frustrating me for a really long time is whenever, you know, we hear people talk about Ukraine's neo-Nazi problem, for me, I always think about Russia, right? For me, like, I don't know if you guys have seen it or any of the people in our audience have seen it, but there's a documentary by Reggie Yates, and he's obviously a British black man who goes to Russia and sort of investigates the neo-Nazi situation in Russia. And it's just so, it's not, you know, one of the most in-depth investigations, but it just illustrates the fact that Russia itself, whilst telling Ukraine that we have this problem, are themselves, you know, where to me as a Ukrainian, I just remember even from like teenage years and things like that, always hearing about these like horrific stories of like executions by neo-Nazis in Russia and just the rise of like skinheads and all of this stuff. And so I just wanted to ask Katya maybe and then Nika as well, the thing that people miss a lot of the time is this actual direct connection between the Russian neo-Nazi movement and whatever is happening across the world and in Ukraine and whatever. So I was just wondering if you could tell us just a little bit more about the role that, you know, Russian neo-Nazi skinheads, etc., play in sort of fostering a lot of what we're seeing happening across the world today, and maybe in Ukraine in particular as well.
Yeah, thank you for the question. It's really really interesting, because I think that Russian neo-Nazis are playing the same big role in the situation as Russia itself plays its role in imperialism and in colonialism, because that it's all started from Russia, from those skinhead movements. It came from football fan clubs that created actually those radicals who were fighting with each other all the time, and it was really bloody mess in the beginning of like 90s and 2000, like the beginning of the century. And they created this huge movement. It was like not in control of officials. They didn't want to, you know, to put them all in prison. They tried to use them for internal propaganda. They were scary for the population, because people have seen that they are beating people on the streets. There were big fights, and officials just created this kind of a terror fear, like it was with Chechnya during the war. And actually, Tesak, who was very, very famous in the far-right circles, he was the one who escaped prison in Russia, and he could freely do whatever he wanted. So he created this sexy radical movement for young Russians that are against queer and, you know, people with a color skin, and this was huge movement. And as I told you before, when Russia annexed Crimea, it divided the movement, and a lot of people with this brainwashed mind just moved to Ukraine, and they started to they tried to create something like they have seen in Russia, yeah, in which they participated in Russia. It was, you know, the same patterns.
Yeah, and you have, by the way, your reporting is also mentioned many times, very strong ties between Russian fascists that moved to Ukraine and FSB and Russian's state security services, and something that unfortunately hasn't been covered as much. And I think that people also... It kind of in my head is very bizarre situation when Russia is sponsoring far rights all across the world, especially in Europe. It actually is friends with the most fascist regimes you can possibly find. Yet the focus is still on far rights in Ukraine that don't have any political even power in the country.
And, but sorry to interrupt you. I just wanted to tell that I think that like most of the those Russian far right who came to Ukraine, they were not paid by Russia. They were just brainwashed with you know this ideology with this movements and they just. Obviously, they had benefits for what they were doing still yeah, in Ukraine, but the source of the money was different. They just switched. And sometimes you know it is hard to say. Do these people really share the same ideology? So I would rather say that many of them promote some radical views to receive public approval. For example, we could see that people can protest pro-Russian politics, like Medvedchuk, and tomorrow they will attack queer people, and this worked because they were respected in some pro-democratic, pro-Ukrainian protest activities, and when they attacked queer people, nobody wanted to resist them. For example, police even, because they could easily say that whoever criticized those groups are pro-Russian. So the main problem, I guess, was that the police didn't react properly to these cases, to this violence.
I think as a queer person, as also as a person who's you know been all many years on the front line of this standoff between far rights and our attempts to publicly protest as queer Ukrainians, I think it's been also a journey. So I say that the support from law enforcement got not support, but them doing their job protecting our public events became better and better with years. And of course, you know, even now, for example, seeing police and interior ministry engaging with us amid genocide on the issues of hate crime legislation and how to make sure that this legislation is finally passed. This for me is extremely, I'm very glad to see it. As a queer person, we started basically in such a horrible situation almost a decade ago, and seeing this progress is very important for me. But wanted to move to Nika a bit. I have a question for you about, again, global media coverage and global perception of this problem outside. So, and again, in these explainers that Stas and Marichka shared, they basically also touch upon how global media pick up Russian narratives about fascists in Ukraine. And they say, like, I'm quoting, that independent media are still biased. They seek balance and tend to give voice to all sides of the conflict. They also have to write things that get more clicks and reads. That's why so many Western journalists have picked up the narrative of Ukrainian Nazis and have been covering it excessively since 2014, leaving the big picture of Russian aggression out of focus. As a result, you see little coverage of Nazi groups in Russia or literally fascist Russian organizations fighting for Russia in Donbas. But for some reason, everybody has heard about the Ukrainian Azov Battalion. Would you agree that this is more or less accurate portrayal? And also, you know, how do you feel about these imbalances, if they are really there, in your opinion?
I think that if we think that way, we can like go into this very unpleasant whataboutism. We still have this problem, and even I had a discussion where I was like asking the same thing, and the person who works for one of the like major media corporations of the United States, he explained that the reason why you see Ukrainian coverage of like Ukrainian Nazis is that because Ukraine is in focus, and media has like have to always find the topic that will draw attention of readers. And for some reason, when you hear the word Nazi, it is like a magnet for the audience. Therefore, some major corporations, they do not care about the nuance or what their story can do to the country like Ukraine. What they care is to write another very loud story, for example, like one of the Azov fighters is training American Nazis, or U.S. senators want to include Azov into the list of terrorist organizations. Why they're doing that is that because Azov is always in the media, and therefore Azov is special. I would say, like, I had a conversation with Svetoslav Palamar, one of the Azov commanders who is now in Russian captivity. It was like 2 days before they got into captivity and surrendered to Russians. And he told me that he thinks that partly Russian propaganda is working very hard to cement the narrative of the Azov Nazis into the minds of the West, because we all know that Russia today has billions of finances, like every year. We all may be jealous as media workers of that budget. So yes, we cannot compete with such a machine. And the fact that we are trying to say that no, they are not Nazis, doesn't work here, because as you mentioned, it's he said, she said situation, or like the both sides situation. Why I think it still sticks is because of the Azov emblem. Unfortunately, the emblem is still the weakest point of this regiment, because Wolfshangel is still considered a Nazi symbol, even despite the fact that many German provinces still have this symbol on their flags. So I think this symbol and the white sun that used to be on the chevrons, and I think it's not that common anymore, is main argument of the Azov critics and Ukraine critics, because as you see, even the Kremlin says that the first thing you should do if you want to uncover a Ukrainian Nazi is to look at the tattoos and symbols he wears. And as Vyacheslav Lihachev told me, is not things are not even about symbols right now, but about actions. And while Azov bearing this Wolfshangel-looking symbol is fighting for Ukraine and defending the nation, the Z warriors are behaving as actual Nazis, because we all heard about the numerous witnesses' statements of what they were doing. And also what I really hate is that people do have very short memory, and they do not remember and do not read anymore a clear fascist manifesto published by RIA. I guess it was in April. It says, "What should we do with Ukraine?" And it's basically the Übermensch, Untermensch theory, but for Russia, which says that millions of us should be destroyed, that we should be re-educated, that all our media representatives, intelligentsia, so-called, should be killed, because it is
the final solution for Ukraine.
Yes. But people, for some reason, they did not notice that, and this is, I guess, it may be one of the main evidences of who's the real Nazis is here.
I think it's maybe it's also comes from a bit of confusion, especially abroad, because between nationalism and patriotism. Because, for example, I have this tattoo of the word freedom in Ukrainian on my hand. And for some, you know, people outside in the West, especially far left people, the exhibit, public exhibit of love for your country, of patriotism. For them, it's automatically somehow turns into fascism or nationalism, which I don't really understand even. But for them, this is all the same. And I think this is creates a lot of confusion for people out abroad as well. They treat all us as like, you know, patriotic people. This is the same as fascists or something like that. This is a really bizarre. Okay, guys, I think unfortunately we'll have to wrap up soon. But before we go to our final question, I also want to quickly ask Katya about the issue that you definitely have online with a lot of, as a journalist, with a lot of bullying and accusation that this is wrong to pick up those topics to cover them. How do you feel like, do you understand where it comes from? Do you feel like this is something that bothers you much? Would you like to address it? Because I know that's a huge issue for sure, for not only for you, for many journalists these days, but how do you usually approach this?
Sure. Many people think that if you have covered a far-right topic, it means that you played in Putin's hand and helped him to invade Ukraine. People really have a short memory and they don't want to read actually the sources. When it comes to thought what can I say to those haters, right, who are telling that, I can say that Russia could use anything to attack Ukraine. They just wanted to eliminate Ukrainians and to destroy Ukraine, and they just choose some of the points that they could use, and we all know, like people who are sane know that Russia didn't have any right to liberate anyone from anything. They didn't have a literal right to invade Ukraine, and when they explain it by some far right neo-Nazi issues or anything else, it's just their reason to attack Ukraine. It doesn't have any with the reality. We have a right to any important issues in Ukraine, because we live here and we have a right for that, and Russia shouldn't, you know, intervene in any internal affairs of the another country, and also I think the West should learn that they didn't look at Russia when it came to Nazism, actually, and they just should learn history and story and history of those movements and the roots of the Russian Nazism. I hope that this invasion will be not good start, but just the actual start for this conversation with
Yeah. And we were just talking to Maxim. I think I was saying that, you know, sometimes it's so hard to like talk about a topic without sometimes reinforcing or like bringing out painful or, you know, some of these misconceptions that we're talking about. But I'm glad that we did today, because it's super, I think, important for people to hear directly from you, from Nika as well, and for us Ukrainians to feel comfortable enough with talking about this publicly and to everyone around us.
Yeah, but that's what journalists also do. I think by default, we talk about the topics of public interest and importance, no matter how complicated they are. So I do get that people get frustrated that some topics might be not timely in their view, but this is the difference between Ukraine and Russia. We're here have the right and freedom to talk and discuss and debate and disagree, while as in Russia, there is nothing of sorts, and freedom of expression on or journalism is not there anymore. So let's remember that as well.
So this is a perfect segue into our last favorite question that we always ask everyone, and this is a little bit, I guess, for us Ukrainians to, build what it means to be Ukrainians in general for ourselves and our nation and so on and so and sort of create that moving forward. But maybe Nika first, what does it mean to be Ukrainian for you, and has that changed since the beginning of this full-scale invasion, and if it did, how?
I actually haven't changed. I changed like 2 years before the full-scale invasion started, when I switched to Ukrainian language, because I was raised in a Russian-speaking family of Soviet professors, and I saw nothing wrong in speaking Russian, and I still see nothing wrong. Like for other people, but for me it was the question of identity, because when I was abroad and I was speaking Russian, people were like thinking I was Russian and knowing nothing about my nation, and it was really tricky and hard for them to explain what was the difference between a Ukrainian and the Russian, and why do I speak Russian if I'm a Ukrainian. So yes, for me it was the language issue, to understand my nation, my culture, because I usually didn't see anything wrong with Pole speaking Polish and all people who live in Poland, they still have to study Polish, but for some reason in Ukraine, language was an issue, and many of our like own citizens didn't want to learn it, and I guess it's the key part of the identity. What changed after the start of the full-scale invasion is that I understood that I no longer can think and care about only myself and my well-being. I have to help others, and I'm actually proud of the fact that I donated like my monthly salary like in 2 months. I feel no like remorse, if I can say so. I don't feel that I lost those money. I feel that somebody who need them more got them. So yeah, I've become less greedy.
I think this is exactly the reason. I mean, we've all been, working hard and doing our jobs and volunteering, but also donating as hell over these 4 months. And I've never felt, of course, better about donating. But this is also the reason why still 90% of all humanitarian assistance in Ukraine, and partially military as well, is still covered by Ukrainians, not by our allies. So yeah, thank you, Nika, for sharing that. Katya, I know, we got to wrap up, but the same question to you, especially I think it's a special one since you're Ukrainian by choice. So I know it's been a journey for you in recent years, but has it changed in any way in recent months, and what it means for you to be Ukrainian these days?
I always explain to foreigners what is like to live in Ukraine and to be Ukrainian, that it means to be free, and it really means a lot to me, just to be free, to be able to speak about difficult topics, about like everything that that you could, you know, think about. It means that you have a really special sense of community, that people really, really like to help each other, and this is something I never seen such passion in another countries, in other nations, because I think Ukrainians are very, very strong, and they are fighting literally for freedom, and when it comes to this invasion, it's just prove it that we all really can fight till the end for our freedom, just to make sure that that we are not afraid to talk about things, and I guess this is the most powerful thing about Ukraine.
Powerful indeed, yeah, because you know, as we like to say, freedom is our religion, and I think it runs true, especially today. Thank you so much, both for you, Katya and Nika.
Thank you, guys. You are doing an amazing job.
Thank you for your time. Thank you for coming. As we say to all people, you know, all our featured Ukrainians, Ukrainian spaces is for you to claim. So at any point you want to come back and talk about the issues you want to talk, you claim this space and you come back, and we have you once again, because it's been an important conversation. But also, as a fellow journalist, I have such a big respect to your work, and I think what you do for Ukrainian journalism, especially these days, is extremely important. So thank you so much. And for everybody else, you know, guys, I know that you often have questions or requests. So if you want to have a priority seat and ask questions to our guests, maybe even in person, please consider becoming our Patreon sponsors. This is a right that our sponsors on Patreon have, and we provide them. For everyone else, we try to accommodate your questions and comments if you use the hashtag Ukrainian Spaces. And if you send it in advance, that would be amazing, because we're still a small team and we cannot handle requests while we're on broadcast so easily. So please claim that hashtag, leave suggestions, the topics you want to cover, the questions for our upcoming guests, or maybe even your own story, especially if you're Ukrainians. This is a hashtag for you to claim. We love to amplify it. And also, these conversations are being recorded and then uploaded as podcasts on all podcast platforms. So check it out there and support us there as well. That means a lot. So that's it. I think apart from one thing is Slava Ukraini.
Героям слава.